Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Saunderson, and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Welcome to Little Atoms. Tonight with me, Neil Denny, and with the first of our monthly guest hosts, Becky Hogg. Becky Hogg is a freelance writer and researcher, formerly executive director of the Open Rights Group and a former technology director of Open Democracy. She is currently a board member of the Open Knowledge Foundation. Becky writes and broadcasts on technology, civil rights, and intellectual property in the digital age for publications such as The New Statesman, The Guardian, and Index on Censorship. This show consists of a pre-recorded interview with the environmentalist Stuart Brand. On the day of the interview, Stuart had a terrible cold, so he's quite croaky, but please bear with us because it's a fantastic interview, which starts now with Becky introducing Stuart.
Stuart Brand is a social entrepreneur and founder of the award-winning Pollef catalogue. He appears several times in Tom Wolfe's account of 1960s psychedelia, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. He is a recurrent figure in the history of the personal computer and the internet, helping to found the Homebrew Computer Club in the 1970s and coining the phrase "information wants to be free" in the 1980s. More recently, he is co-founder of the Long Now Foundation and founder of futurist consultancy Global Business Network. A trained biologist and lifelong environmentalist, his new book, Whole Earth Discipline, an Eco-Pragmatist Manifesto, is out in the UK this month. Stuart Brand, welcome to Little Atoms.
Well, thank you kindly. Sorry about my voice.
Stuart, in your new book, you make a compelling case for how ideology has distorted the environmental movement, and in particular, stopped it from embracing the very technologies and trends that are civilization's best hope of surviving man-made climate change. What are these technologies, and why are they being rejected by parts of the green movement?
Yeah, that's a well-stated question. I've been an environmentalist all my life, and one of the things that environmentalists typically do is have a very strong feeling about nature, because often they've had some very strong experience in person with nature. And then that often leads to, I think, an illusion that nature and human activities are quite separate. And in a sense, this is a whole book saying that they are inseparable. What humans do and what nature does are all locked up together. And as a consequence, the environmentalist aversion to technology in many cases is misplaced. And so specifically in the book, I'm saying that, especially in light of climate change, which environmentalists get full credit for calling attention to very early in the process and being very concerned, most concerned of any group now. But once you take climate change seriously, you need to take some technologies such as nuclear energy, such as transgenic food crops, and genetic engineering, equally seriously. And this is where the kind of romantic identification with nature and assuming that technology is somehow the opposite of nature gets in the way for many environmentalists. Because I was trained as a biologist, as an ecologist back in the 1950s, I've always been pretty comfortable with biotech. I was not comfortable with nuclear engineering and nuclear power in all of its forms until quite recently, because I had taken the environmentalist stance of, well, we should not condemn future generations to having to take care of our nuclear waste. With climate change, I had to relook at nuclear, as many environmentalists are now doing. Realized I was wrong about a number of things there. And in the course of that, I also learned a lot about coal. And once you start looking at coal in any depth as an environmentalist, you have to say, whoa, this is terrible. How do we replace coal? And then you start looking at, yeah, what do you do about that?
Well, we'll look at some of the reasons why you change your mind over nuclear power a bit later in the show. But first of all, I want to start with what I've noticed from the reviews of the book is that is the section that seems the people are most surprised with in there. Is the beginning of the book where you talk about cities and about the new urbanism and basically about sort of the vibrancy of squatter towns in the developing world. Let's talk about where you first discovered that, you know, there was something to be found, something to learn from how people are living in the developing world.
Well, again, there's environmentalists have a romantic feeling about rural life in general and village life in particular, and there's this kind of Gandhi-esque view that the soul of any country is in its villages and so on. A woman named Kavita Ramdas from India, when she's now head of the Global Fund for Women, pointed out to me that for women, village life sucks. And basically, a woman is enthralled to the village, to the family elder, to her husband, and to tradition. And her job is to fetch fuel and water and have lots and lots of children, and that's her entire job. And she gets to sing while she's pounding millet, but that's about all the joy she gets to have. What happens with these women when they move to town is, frankly, they get liberated and they get empowered. And Kavita Ramdas pointed that out to me, and then I started asking everybody I knew who'd been traveling around the world, what do you see in the villages where you're traveling? They said, they're emptying out. Basically, everybody's moving to town all over the world. And indeed, the numbers are overwhelming. 1.3 million people a week are new in town, mostly coming from the countryside. And so, first of all, you've got to say, okay, nobody's forcing those people to do that. It sounds like it was not that wonderful in the countryside. So the romantic delusion kind of gets broken through there. And they're going after opportunity. They're going off after participation in the cash economy, which when you're a subsistence farmer, you really don't have that. Subsistence farming is very, very tough. It's a lot of work. You have some bad weather and you're stuck. It's dangerous. There's not medical care nearby. All of those things are improved by moving to town. But ecologically, when people stop subsistence farming, typically the natural environment grows back very quickly. The forest comes back, the wildlife comes back, and that's all good news ecologically. So as I pursued that, I came to realize what a number of environmentalists have been picking up on, which is that life in the cities is actually the greenest thing that people do. You have less impact in terms of energy and materials and everything else when you're all packed together in a city.
It could be said here that we're going from romanticising life in the countryside, as you described the environmentalists doing, to romanticising what are essentially slums and sort of slum dwelling. But you talk very vividly about the, well, I suppose, entrepreneurial spirit of people to get out. You know, people are going to live in slums, sure, but all they want to do is get out of those slums eventually.
Either to get out of the slums or to improve the slums. And either way, the main point is not how bad it is, and it indeed can be very, very bad indeed. But is there motion? Are people getting a chance, driving a rickshaw or whatever, you know, a rupee a day, nevertheless, some kind of cash income gives them a shot at moving up, and that's what they're mainly doing. And this is something that economists are still discovering, that the so-called informal economy, which is huge in the developing world, is not a drag on the formal economy. It's actually underpinning for the formal economy. And these things are not hurting prosperity. They're helping prosperity. So the slums, hopefully, huge as they are, I mean, we're talking about 1 billion people in the world. Another 1 billion are expected as people keep moving from the countryside. Everybody's pretty busy getting the hell out of poverty. And as they do that, they're improving the situation not only for themselves, but for the cities and for the countries they're in. Now, this has implications for energy because they want city-style electricity. Base load electricity, and that's mostly in the developing world, that's done by burning coal, which is not so good for the atmosphere and the climate. Likewise, they're moving up in terms of food, better food, toward meat, toward higher energy demanding food sources, and that also starts at the point for what are your most efficient ways of making food, and that gets me interested in the genetically engineered food crops. So this is an issue not just of a lot of people moving to cities, but the urbanization in the developing world, which is where 5 out of 6 people live, 5-point-something billion people, they are on the move, and how they move is going to affect how everybody's climate is over the coming century.
This obviously has had some effect on changing your opinions towards nuclear. Mm-hmm. What else was going on at that time that made you more pro-nuclear? And I think you used the phrase glow-in-the-dark green, which I really like in the book. What was happening around that time?
Basically, is I guess the younger Greens who didn't personally have experience of Hiroshima or Nagasaki, which is especially strong for Americans, or for Chernobyl, indeed, in Three Mile Island. And so the nuclear doesn't look like a cursed technology, it just looks like a technology. And then they start looking at it in detail, and especially in terms of basically new information that is emerging from the next generation of nuclear power that is coming along, and reassessed in light of better information, which is what I did, and which I think many environmentalists concerned about climate are doing, nuclear looks pretty damn good. It's interesting to me that Greenpeace UK, which has been fighting nuclear for a long time, I understand, is not actively fighting nuclear now. That may be partly because of Stephen Tyndale, who was head of Greenpeace UK for a number of years, came out actively pro-nuclear. And this is, and also you've got James Lovelock, the Gaia hypothesis guy, who's been extremely pro-nuclear. In the U.S., you've got one of our leading climatologists, James Hansen, who's the person behind the number 350, saying that we must take the current 387 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and take it not level it off, but take it back down to 350. He is extremely pro-nuclear. And very much in terms of the next generation of nuclear, which is more efficient, is safer, is less likely to get involved in weapons proliferation, and has a wide variety of uses. So both in biotechnology and in nuclear technology, these two sciences and these two engineering domains are moving very rapidly. And those changing facts on the ground are changing policy, I hope.
Let's look at the usual dangers that are raised by people when they argue against nuclear power, and these would be that it's extremely expensive, there's a possibility of accidents, there's a possibility of somebody, terrorists or whatever, getting hold of material to turn into weapons-grade material. There's an idea that there could be a low level of radiation around where nuclear power stations are based. And then, of course, there's also the problem of what you do with the waste, how you store the waste, how you deal with that. And you basically tackle every one of these problems in the book.
Well, one has to deal with each one. It's only one chapter in my book out of 9. It's a fairly long chapter. Because typically the arguments against nuclear are, one says, well, it's too expensive and therefore you must not have nuclear. Well, you know, wind is also very expensive and solar is very expensive. But one never says, well, solar is expensive, so we mustn't have it. Or they'll say, well, there's this issue of nuclear waste, and therefore we must not have nuclear. So that's why you have to go through every single issue. And it's important to do so because, in fact, on each of the issues, there's better information than I had as an environmentalist, frankly. Just to take waste for an example, I had not realized how extremely small the amount of waste that comes out of nuclear power plants is. One standard figure that people find impressive is that if each person's entire life of electricity came from nuclear, the amount of waste that would come from a lifetime's worth of nuclear power would fit in a soda can. It's a very small amount. Now, that'd be a heavy soda can. But still, you're not talking about a huge amount of waste like you get from coal, where the gigatons of carbon dioxide and slurry and all the rest of it. Then there's, with the once-through nuclear waste issue, which means that at present it's economic to use the nuclear fuel in a relatively inefficient way, so that the waste actually has over 95% of the energy still in it. So either you can reprocess it the way the French do and get a lot more juice out of it and make even less waste, or you can use it as direct fuel in the next generation of nuclear power, the integral fast reactor plants, and in which case it's not waste at all. It's very valuable fuel. And in any case, you have plenty of time to think about it because we put nuclear waste now, the smaller quantity that exists, in these dry cask storage containers out back of the parking lot at reactor sites, where it's perfectly safe for 100 or 200 years while we think about what we want to do with it. And so the whole issue of nuclear waste as you deal with it in detail kind of comes apart. And that happens with each one of these. Now, an abiding issue is the cost of nuclear. And I think the primary point to make is it's not that nuclear is expensive, it's that coal is cheap. And coal is the cheapest form of baseload electricity we could make. But it's killing us because of what it's doing in the atmosphere and to the climate. So one way or another, coal has to be either made expensive or illegal. As you do that, nuclear and the other forms of renewable, of clean power, start to look much more attractive. The other workaround on nuclear is part of the new generation of nuclear plants is what are called the small modular reactors. And these are very small indeed. So instead of 1.2, 1.6 gigawatts, you're down to 25 to maybe 125 megawatts, like a 60th the size of the big ones. And they're modular, so you can get a small one, put it in, run a small city with it, and then if it works well, add another one a few years later. It's easy to finance step by step. These things live in the ground. They don't require a huge apparatus of people and stuff to run them. They're manufactured at a factory and then just trucked in or trained in, and you don't have to build them on site. Everything moves much more quickly. The design cycle is much faster, so they get better faster. And basically, the small reactors look to me like a way around a whole lot of these issues. So as you say, as you take these things detail by detail and look at it from an engineering standpoint of, what is the risk balancing, what are the ways that you manage these problems and solve them.
I'd like to talk about engineers and what they can contribute maybe a little later on in the show, but in this issue with nuclear waste reprocessing, which of course throws up, I think, is it plutonium and other potentially proliferation materials that then are at risk of proliferation. Right. And again, when you talk about evolutionary microbial research, you talk about the need for global governance. And you're quite explicit about the shift that you've made from the sort of individualist approach to, this is more about, less about individual action and more about action on the sort of global governance level. Quite early on in the book, you make that statement. Obviously, this came out in the US in October. It's coming out in the UK, your book, in January. Since then, we've had the Copenhagen climate negotiations.
Right.
And I just wonder how you view the potential for global governance to solve these problems in light of what most people have accepted as a failed set of negotiations at the end of last year.
I am not for global government. And indeed, the people who are most upset about the denialists of climate change are just sure that Greens have a secret agenda to have one global government, and there will be the UN will send black helicopters to enforce it and so on. I don't think that's what we're looking at. But we are looking at the need to make coal expensive. And there's no other entity besides governments that can make coal expensive. So if the European nations and the North American nations and China and India make coal expensive, then we have a chance.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't, then we've got deep problems. This can't be done by green organizations. It can't be done by corporations. It can't be done by cities. It can't be done by any other entity at the scale that we need to deal with a global problem like climate. And so this old libertarian is saying, go government, do your job, take the long-term responsibility that we hire you to do and make coal expensive. Then nuclear and solar and wind and other things that I hope will come along can fight it out to provide baseload electricity. The other issue where the global governance, I think, will be of huge import has to do with geoengineering, the idea of direct intervention in climate. This is scientifically, engineering, and in terms of government policy, a fraught area. I think we will not have time to fix climate change the way we're going. Copenhagen was an example of how very slow the overall human response is to cutting back on carbon. But even if we do cut back on the greenhouse gases, so much has already gone into the atmosphere that we have a long lag time there, and we need to buy time to get control of our greenhouse gas emissions. And my expectation is we'll use some form of geoengineering to do that. Now, the problem with geoengineering is everybody's downwind of everybody else. And geoengineering, some of the forms of it are so inexpensive that any individual nation or even any individual really rich person could just do it, could just change the climate for everybody. At which point you can be sure that everybody else will say, just a damn minute. So if China, for perfectly good reasons, because of droughts in the Northwest, and because of flooding and sea level rise in the South China coast, they may just say this is intolerable and we're going to put sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere at the stratospheric level instead of down in the lower levels the way they've been doing in order to mitigate the climate problem. Probably in the U.S. we would say that's an act of war. And you don't want that. So some form of very strong agreements are going to be needed in order to even think about doing geoengineering. And those kind of agreements need to be arrived at sooner rather than later. The science to find out what forms of geoengineering might work need to go on sooner rather than later. There needs to be enormous international transparency in that research, so everybody understands what's being tried. And that's a process that is going to be, I think, dominating the right up through the middle, maybe the whole of this century. And that's why governments now, I think, have a huge role to play.
You're listening to Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny, and our guest host, Becky Hogg, and we're talking to Stuart Brand about his book, Whole Earth Discipline.
I believe that when you're talking about geoengineering and the political and technical solutions that we'll need to even start to think about doing that, that you refer to the Internet Engineering Task Force as a potential model, the sort of rough consent and running code. Have I got that right, or is that in
another part? That's quite right, yeah.
And you can see also, I mean, Wikipedia and governance there, the eternal vigilance of the Wikipedian is also mentioned. This idea of the engineer being a potential new player on the scene and able to almost negotiate between scientists on the one hand and romantics on the other by just coming in and trying to fix the problem. I wonder how far that's informed by your previous exposure to the rise of communications technology.
That's interesting. Well, my father was an engineer, and one of my older brothers was an engineer. Engineers have this kind of refreshing approach to problems, which is rather than treating them as a tragedy, which we like to do in the environmental movement, and, you know, oh dear, we're losing all of the soil, or we're losing all of the species. And the problem is the essence of tragedy is that it cannot be fixed. And the essence of engineering is that anything can be fixed, mate. And if it's a, you know, seemingly intractable problem, then an engineer is even more intrigued. Fixing climate, oh, well, no, that's fascinating. We don't even know how climate works, but we've got to fix it. And, I mean, part of how an engineer does that is you reframe the problem into a form that can be fixed. And mathematicians do a similar thing. You just, okay, it looks like an intractable problem because we're looking at it the wrong way. Find another angle on this thing or take it apart into various pieces and then solve the pieces and then maybe the whole will come together. So an engineer's approach is partly enormous. Very, very close study, and that's why they use the scientific data as much as possible. What's actually going on here? What are the dynamics of the situation? And where can I tweak it, ideally in the minimal way, to get the desired result instead of the undesired thing that's happening that we don't like? And then start testing that, and it'll be wrong at first, but maybe part of it is right, or one of the later things starts to work, and then you add to that, and by, you've got something that works pretty damn well. Now you can go on to the next problem. I hung out with hackers, sort of outlaw programmers, very early on, and did a conference we called the Hackers Conference way back in 1983, 84. And hackers have this wonderful sort of shortcut approach to solving problems, which is just figure out the fiendishly clever thing to do to make the right thing happen and then just do it. I have a feeling there's, you know, we're going to be hacking all sorts of things. We're hacking agriculture, we're going to be hacking climate, and that's a shift for environmentalists from, you know, just leave it alone and it will take care of itself, which is sometimes true, to, in this case, intervening, but I would say both as an environmentalist and as a hacker, intervene as minimally as you can. Mm-hmm. Intervene just enough to make the wrong thing stop and the right thing start, and then watch that carefully. Hence the idea of the vigilance principle is that you are always watching what's going on to see if there's good surprises, bad surprises, and what you might do about those. And we're starting to see in the environmental movement a beginnings of an engineering approach. So building design has been one of the huge wastes of both materials and energy. And in the U.S., the lead approach of, you know, very, very carefully designed buildings that are green in every aspect of them, and then being highly honored and so on, that's the sort of thing that helps. And likewise, city design, some environmentalists are catching on that while cities are very green as they are, they can be a hell of a lot more green than they are, and there are many things that we can do there. So this engineering activist approach instead of just a political activist approach is, I think, what's proving very promising.
One of the most, I thought, passionate and heart-hitting chapters in the book was where you spoke about the approach of some major green organisations to GM, and in particular work in Africa to keep GM out of Africa, which basically left millions starving for a European ideology. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about GM and transgenic foods and genetically engineered foods and the role you see them playing in the future.
I think as physicists said that they've known sin with the atomic bombs, to some extent environmentalists, particularly in Europe, have known sin by resisting genetically engineered food crops in Africa. Tropical agriculture is so different from the temperate zone agriculture we have in England and in the U.S. They don't have winters, and so the pests that normally die in the north don't die. They use a number of crops which are specific to those areas like sorghum and cassava and so on. All of those crops, almost all of them, have problems of one sort or another. And likewise in Asia, rice, for example. With transgenic engineering, genetic engineering, we now have rice which has the precursors of vitamin A, have had it for 10 years. In Africa, there are genetically engineered crops which are drought tolerant. There are engineered crops which are biofortified, like cassava, who have the various micronutrients that you need to have for, and even protein. And Greenpeace International, based in Amsterdam, and Friends of the Earth International, based in Amsterdam, have been strongly fighting against GM, as you say, genetic modified, or I think a better term is GE, genetically engineered food crops in Africa and in South Asia. This is no small matter because millions of people depend on these food crops and they need to be much better than they are. They need to not only be better than they are for feeding the people there, they need to be better than they are for feeding the world, for being a major cash export crop for Africa. And because of Europe being so, I think, irrational about GE food crops and refusing to import them, this hurts African export nations enormously. That's gradually changing, partly because time has gone by and people thought harmful things would occur with transgenic crops, and the harmful things have not occurred, not to human health and not to the ecology. In fact, the ecology is greatly helped, usually by the engineered food crops. An example of that would be soybeans, which is particularly strong in Latin America. About 90% of soybeans in Latin America and in North America now are engineered. They're engineered to be tolerant of herbicides. And so as a result, one application of herbicides instead of many, right at the time the crops are coming up and the crops come up, so you don't need to plow. This is no-till agriculture. No-till agriculture, it saves vast amounts of energy.
It's a huge cause for the organic movement, no-till agriculture, isn't it? It's one of the...
Well, this is interesting. Organic farming, they still plow. There is no-till form of organic because that's the way that they deal with weeds. And they're trying to work around this because they know that when you plow, bad things happen for the atmosphere. A lot of bacteria are very active when you plow. And so a lot of the life that is in the soil comes out as methane and carbon dioxide. When you don't do that, the soil gets richer and richer. You don't feed a lot of these gases into the atmosphere. And it's just better not to plow. And you can do that with the engineered food crops. And so far, the organic farmers can't. But it's moving along, so people are catching on that the engineered crops are very good. Farmers have known this for a long time. So in Brazil, for example, transgenic crops were illegal, but they were legal in Argentina. And they were so much more successful that people were smuggling the seeds across the border. And gradually, Brazil caught on and said, oh, okay, and legalized it. And this is happening increasingly around the world. There has never been a agricultural technology as successful as genetic engineering. So my fellow environmentalists who say, well, this is bad for farmers, are not talking to the farmers.
Well, we've been talking to Stuart Brand about his book Whole Earth Discipline, and it's out this month in the UK from Atlantic Books. But to finish off, Stuart, you're also the president and a co-founder of something called the Long Now Foundation. Can we talk about what that is, what it does, and basically, I suppose, what is the philosophy behind the Long Now Foundation?
The philosophy behind the Long Now Foundation is that civilization has revved itself into a kind of a pathological state of short-termism, of everything having to happen very rapidly, and business, you know, moving from the quarterly report to the daily stock price, politics moving from the U.S. two-year congressional re-election cycle to the daily poll reports. And as you focus more and more on the short term, which is fine, lots of fun things are going on in all these accelerating parts of society and science and technology and everything else. If in the course of doing that you lose track of some of the important long-term stuff, then you may lose important balance. And so the idea of the Long Now Foundation is to take the idea that just as we sort of think of the now as today and last week and next week, how about today and the last 10,000 years and the next 10,000 years? That's the long now. That term came from Brian Eno here in Britain, who suggested that the long now is actually a kind of a responsible way to think about things, and also, frankly, an exciting way to think about things. The next 10,000 years should have a lot going on. The Long Now Foundation has a project which is well along, called the 10,000-year clock. And we're building a clock inside a mountain. The main one will be in Nevada. Another one is in Texas. And the idea of the 10,000-year clock is that it really does keep very good time in a monumental and visitable way. You go inside the mountain, and then you're inside the clock, and you're in there for a few hours. And then you come out the top of the mountain. And in the case of Nevada, see 100 miles in every direction. And that's the long view. You're also surrounded by bristlecone pine trees that are alive and 5,000 years old on this particular site. And all of this is a way to start taking the long term very seriously, and with a kind of a clear and present sense that we live in the long term as well as in the short term. And that combination is part of what makes it fun to be alive.
It's probably worth mentioning that the prototype for the Clock of the Long Now is here in London in our Science Museum, and is on permanent exhibition. In fact, I've seen it, and it's pretty impressive.
And the Science Museum is a bloody wonder in its own right. It's just a fabulous spot. They were great fun to work with, to have that clock there.
Stuart, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thanks for speaking to Little Atoms today.
Well, my pleasure. I'm sorry I have a cold today. I have a peculiar voice. Normally, I'm normal.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website at littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.